Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's Ira Melman.
The U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan is warning that distressingly high levels of violence threaten to derail ongoing peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Zalmay Khalilzad's comments come as renewed fighting for days has plagued Afghanistan's southern Helmand province, a longtime Taliban stronghold. The Taliban this Friday agreed to halt its attacks on condition of the U.S. stopping its airstrikes in the area, but then came a suicide car bombing Sunday that killed at least 13 people and wounded around 120 others in Afghanistan's western Ghor province. Though no one claimed responsibility for the bombing, suspicion immediately fell on the Taliban. An expert in Washington says the Taliban's increasing violence in recent days have shown that the Taliban is actually using the space created by negotiations to continue to push for U.S. troop withdrawal. VOA's Gilo Nure spoke with Catherine Zimmerman, resident fellow at American Enterprise Institute. They spoke via Skype.
The Taliban's actions in recent days have shown that the Taliban is actually using the space created by negotiations and probably the decision by the United States to withdraw forces from Afghanistan in order to secure more strength inside of the country in advance of intra-Afghan negotiations. And frankly, it raises the question as to whether the Taliban is dedicating to those negotiations or playing along until the U.S. and other international forces withdraw from the country.
So the February peace agreement in Doha from the U.S. side gave Taliban international legitimacy. Do you think Taliban are using that in trying to advance in these negotiations, or they're trying to legitimize whatever their ideology of Islamic Emirate it is and bring back the type of government they want in Afghanistan?
The negotiations certainly legitimized what the Taliban were pursuing and being recognized on the international stage, something that they actually had not achieved prior to that agreement. The concern that I share with many other analysts is whether the Taliban are willing to accept the Afghan government as it stands, so the one that is currently recognized by the international community, or whether the Taliban still perceives itself to be the legitimate government of Afghanistan, is going to move toward a much more Islamist implementation of governance. And, you know, the advances made over the past two decades, just in terms of liberal governance on the ground, will be erased by the Taliban over the next year, 5 years.
Gilo Nure spoke with Catherine Zimmerman, resident fellow at American Enterprise Institute. As the Afghan Taliban tries to negotiate a political settlement with the government, many musicians in the country are worried about the impact the deal will have on their ability to work, as VOA's Aisha Tansim reports from Kabul.
Musician Javed Parvani was at his regular artist hangout and workplace last month when some people approached him for a job. A wedding was taking place in one of the districts of Kabul province. It is part of Afghan culture to organize a musical evening during wedding celebrations. Khalakan district, close to Bagram Air Base, was long a secure area. But locals say recently, Taliban militants have become active at night. Parvani and his band took the job. He had performed in the area previously without a problem. But this time turned out to be different.
The party was in full swing when my son and his friends reached the venue. That's when they saw 20 to 30 armed Taliban with turbans on their heads and their faces covered surround the gathering. When people saw the Taliban, they ran.
Parwani and his band barely escaped, but the Taliban destroyed their instruments. Local elders were so scared, they refused to let the groom or his family talk to journalists. This narrow dirt street leads to the garden where the musical evening was taking place. We tried to go there, but the local elders stopped us. Worried about their safety and the safety of their area, they do not want to talk about this incident. Pictures of the destroyed instruments went viral on social media, scaring artists all over the country. Parwani said the incident made them feel unsafe, even in the capital, Kabul.
Allah guide them. Why shouldn't we be scared? If they did it there, they will do it here. When they run the government, they will not let us sing.
His thoughts are shared by many in the country. After 40 years of war, Afghans are almost unanimously vying for peace. But many in the artist community are scared that peace may come at the cost of their livelihood and their art. Meanwhile, threats from the Taliban have already reduced Parwani's business to a trickle. He hardly makes $250 a month. It will take his band almost 2 years to earn enough money to buy their musical instruments again. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Kabul.
We are happy you're with us. America's handling of the coronavirus pandemic is an issue that could decide the upcoming U.S. presidential election, as it has taken center stage over ideological fights that dominated past elections. VOA's Brian Patton has more.
At a recent rally with senior citizens in Florida, President Donald Trump again said the end of the coronavirus pandemic is near and the development of a vaccine close at hand.
My message to America's seniors today is one of optimism, confidence, and hope. Your sacrifice has not been in vain. The light at the end of the tunnel is near. We are rounding the turn.
Democratic rival Joe Biden continues to charge the president is downplaying the pandemic as U.S. COVID cases rise.
Turn the corner. My Lord. It's not disappearing. In fact, it's on the rise again.
The pandemic has caused 220 deaths in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins University, as well as an economic recession and to some degree displaced traditional ideological issues that dominated past elections. Experts say free trade, immigration, health care, climate change, abortion rights, and gun control have all been overshadowed by the pandemic.
Those have been supplanted in part by COVID-19. It still exists, but this is like a new issue that didn't exist before, and now is one of the leading issues that defines where the candidates are and how people vote.
The Trump administration's response to the pandemic has become a partisan issue, with Republicans opposing strict economic lockdowns to contain the virus and emphasizing the rights of the individual over mandates to wear masks and social distance.
Whether it's discussions around masks or discussions around the level in which the government should be or shouldn't be involved in public safety or in other elements of our lives, but we're seeing that play out right now.
By contrast, Biden and Democrats urge collective responsibility to bring down the infection rate and allow normal business activity to resume. With a significant lead in presidential polls, Biden remains focused on making the election a referendum on Trump's handling of the pandemic. While the Trump campaign highlights America's robust pre-pandemic economy and promises a swift recovery after the pandemic ends. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. The tech-savvy nation of Singapore will soon become the first country to use facial verification in its national ID system. Millions of people living in Singapore will be able to do a quick face scan to access government agencies, banking services, and other amenities by next year. However, privacy advocates warn the system could be intrusive and vulnerable to abuse. Other citizens are not as concerned with the new technology arriving soon. Shannon Wong, a student in Singapore, is one of them.
I think currently the government does use biometrics in many areas. For example, like at ICA, the borders. So I think they already have the data, and so far there has been no breach or whatsoever, so I'm fine with it.
While facial recognition has already been adopted by companies such as Apple and Google for unlocking phones and replacing typing in passwords, nothing is as ambitious as Singapore's plans for the technology. Tom Fisher, the senior research officer at Privacy International, explains the precautions the nation is taking.
We have to be very cautious about whether consent is genuinely, informed and freely given in these kind of contexts. Speak with the power imbalance between yourself and the government.
The facial verification technology has not fully rolled out, but it's being trialed at some government offices. China's app developers are having to be agile in a world where key markets have turned hostile to their country's tech. While the massively popular app TikTok is facing backlash over the accusation of being a security risk and even being banned in some countries, Chinese developers have been forced to find friendlier markets in the world. A file-sharing app, ShareIt, alongside TikTok and 200 other Chinese apps, have been blacklisted in India but are finding success in new markets in South Africa. The app has already grossed 20 million active users in the country and is now targeting Indonesia, which has the world's fourth largest population. A large component of the success for these apps is the aggressive social media marketing tactics the companies are using. A fast fashion online retailer, Shein, has collaborated with several American influencers and celebrities, such as Rita Ora and Katy Perry, to endorse the app and soar up in App Store rankings. In addition to celebrity endorsements, the store has also advertised a Perry-curated range of affordable shirts, dresses, and accessories. Shein climbed up to the top 5 free shopping apps on Apple's App Store in the U.S., France, and Australia. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Here's Ira Melman.
Thailand's cabinet Tuesday approved a request to recall parliament for a special session to deal with the political pressures from ongoing anti-government protests. There's a deadlock between the government and the student-led protesters who want Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha to step down, the constitution to be amended, and to make it more democratic, and reforms to the monarchy to have it conform to democratic norms. The Thai protesters are learning a whole new language, developed within days to coordinate among crowds of thousands of people at their demonstrations. Libby Hogan reports.
Pointing above their heads means they need umbrellas. Hands held overhead equals need a helmet. And if both hands are crossed, it means supplies are enough. The Thai protesters have called for Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha to stand down and to curb the powers of the monarchy of King Maha Vajiralongkorn. The demonstrations have continued for 3 months. And while they might appear chaotic, between themselves, protesters have developed a whole new language to coordinate themselves among crowds of thousands.
At first, we have to work out what people are saying, but with the gestures, it's pretty easy to guess what they wanted to communicate.
Despite a government ban, the use of water cannon and arrests of many protest leaders, the protests in Bangkok and across the country have grown in defiance. Like-minded activists from Thailand and Hong Kong have shown mutual support for each other under a Milk Tea Alliance hashtag, referring to drinks popular in both places. Some of the words in the Thai hand signal vocabulary also took their inspiration from protesters in Hong Kong. So for water, this is how we do it. This is the sign for goggles. This is helmet. We also pass down messages by shouting Chinese whispers from the front to the back of the crowd or until it reaches the destination. The rapid train of whispers has been seen in action when protesters have cleared the path for ambulances and formed human chains to pass a steady flow of helmets. On the weekend, the protesters' new language began to really take shape, with groups teaching one another and practicing in huddles. The demonstrations have also become more critical of the monarchy, breaking a long-standing taboo, despite potential jail terms of up to 15 years for anyone insulting the king.
That was reporter Libby Hogan. VOA Asia continues. I'm Ira Melman. China appears to have escalated a trade dispute with Australia. Australia's cotton industry says Chinese mills are being told not to process Australian imports. The reported action follows restrictions in China on Australian coal and other agricultural commodities. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In the 19th and 20th centuries, Indigenous children as young as four were forcibly taken from their families to work in mines, on farms, and as domestic servants in Australia. Many received little or no wages, and some were paid only with bread and beef. Lawyers have said conditions were akin to slavery. Until the 1970s, wages earned by Indigenous workers in Western Australia were paid to the state government, but rarely was the money passed on. Lawyers have said as many as 10,000 workers and their descendants would be eligible to join the stolen wages class action lawsuit, which has been filed in Australia's federal court. Jan Sadler is the head of class actions at Shine Lawyers, a legal firm that is leading the court case.
We've been talking to Indigenous Western Australians who are well into their 70s and 80s. Those people have effectively been waiting all their lives to be properly compensated. They're actually waiting to receive their wages from the 1940s and the 1950s, and they still haven't been paid. And this is what that claim is all about.
The Western Australian state government, which is being sued for compensation, has said it hopes a mediated settlement can be reached. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China's Commerce Ministry has released some details of its unreliable entities blacklist, which was first announced in May last year. While Beijing announced the new regulations, it has not published the actual list yet. It comes after U.S. President Donald Trump imposed curbs on Huawei and additional tariffs on Chinese goods. In retaliation, China said it would draw up its own list. It targets foreign firms and individuals violating normal market transactions in the country, interrupting deals with Chinese firms, or taking discriminatory measures against Chinese companies. VOA's Adriana Zhang finds out more from William Rench, Scholl Chair and Senior Advisor at the Center for Strategic International Studies, and for 15 years served as President of the National Foreign Trade Council.
They announced some time ago they were going to do this. They haven't put anybody on the list yet, so it doesn't have any practical significance until they do. And I think we just have to wait and see what that means. I mean, if they put big companies that do a lot of business on the list, it will have a significant impact on trade and on the relationship between our two countries. If they just put small companies that are engaged in not very many activities in China on the list, then it probably won't make a lot of difference.
So are you saying that China actually doesn't have a list yet?
Well, they haven't made one public. I'm sure they're trying to think about who would be on it. But in my experience with the Chinese is that they're very, very careful on things like this, not to do things that hurt themselves. They look for things they can do to hurt us, but they don't want to do any damage to their own economy in the process. And the fact is, our economies are right now are closely related. And you know, if you're going to go after big American companies that are busy in China, you're going to affect a lot of Chinese workers, and they probably are going to think very hard before they decide to do that.
Why did they wait for so long to say that, hey, we're going to punish American or foreign companies after, you know, so many moves made by American government already?
Well, there could be several different explanations. One could be is they're having trouble figuring out who they can target, that where they won't shoot themselves in the foot. And, you know, they have a bureaucracy just like we have a bureaucracy. It takes time sometimes to figure out what to do and what actions you want to take. Because, you know, what's unknown at this point is not only, you know, who might be on the list, but what actions they might end up taking. They don't, you know, they could, are they going to ban those companies from importing things? Are they going to ban them from exporting? Are they going to put them out of business? Are they going to subject them to some sort of monitoring requirements? Are they going to impose some extra tax on them? I mean, I don't think we know what actions they've decided to take, much less who they've decided to take them against.
So some experts actually told me that it's just a bluff. Do you agree?
Not really, no. I don't think the Chinese bluff usually. In my experience is they always retaliate, but they find a way to do it that doesn't hurt them. And I think in this particular case, they're probably having some difficulty figuring that out. The things I just described would have a negative impact on the Chinese economy at a time when the Chinese economy already has its difficulties.
Do you think China would wait actually till, like, after the election?
Well, I think that would depend on their judgment about who's going to win. I mean, nobody knows who's going to win, but if you think that Trump is going to be reelected, then there's no point in waiting. If you think that Biden's going to win, then you might decide that it would be better to wait for him to take over because the tone of the negotiation might be different and the outcome might be different. So, and they might be waiting now just because they don't have a clear picture about that and think that, well, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 weeks from now, it might be more obvious who's going to win and we can decide what to do. They always do something. They try to calibrate what they do to be equivalent to what we've done. So I think they're trying to figure out the magnitude of what we've done. I think there's also the possibility here that and there are signs of this, that they're embarking on their own decoupling path. That Xi Jinping is coming to the conclusion that from his point of view, the Americans are unreliable partners, and that China is better off developing its own technology. And that's, you know, that suggests that China is going to move in the direction of some separation from us, not because of what we've done to them, but because of they find it in their own interest to do that. But they recognize that in the short run, that would be very difficult for them, and it would be very expensive because they rely on us in high-tech sectors for lots of stuff. And so they want to move in that direction, but they don't want to do it so quickly that they end up crippling their own high-tech industries. So they have a lot of things to think about before they take an action.
William Reinsch is the Scholl Chair and Senior Advisor at the Center for Strategic International Studies, speaking with VOA's Adriana Zhang. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Opposition politicians are urging the Australian government to commandeer the design of the Aboriginal flag if copyright disputes are not resolved. The flag was created almost 50 years ago as part of the Aboriginal lands rights movement. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The top half of the Aboriginal flag is black to symbolise Australia's original inhabitants.
The red in the lower half represents the earth, and the circle of yellow in the center signifies the sun. It was created by Harold Thomas, an indigenous artist, in 1971. He owns the copyright and has granted exclusive licenses to three non-Aboriginal companies, which use the design on flags, souvenirs and clothing. These commercial arrangements have been investigated by a parliamentary committee. Opposition Labour Senator Malandiri McCarthy says she's dismayed that sporting and other organisations in Australia have been threatened with legal action for unauthorised use of the flag.
Aboriginal people don't want to be held to ransom for the use of something that has been a symbol of pride and activism over decades.
A Free the Flag campaign has attracted much attention online. It's supported by Nova Peris, a former Australian senator and Olympian.
The fact that the Aboriginal flag has a copyright on it is wrong. The Aboriginal flag is a symbol of our identity and our connection to the land, and we should not be subjected to an individual's decision on when or where we can celebrate our pride.
The Senate inquiry has been weighing up the symbolic power of the Aboriginal flag against an individual's private property rights. It's concluded that the government shouldn't use its constitutional powers to acquire the Aboriginal flag. However, opposition members of the committee have insisted the design should be commandeered if freer access to the flag can't be negotiated by Australia Day in January. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Public opinion polls indicate slightly more older Americans are supporting Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden than President Donald Trump. Patsy Whitaker-Sawara tells us more.
This senior community in Florida is traditionally a Republican stronghold, but after the Democratic National Convention in August, some residents paraded in support of Joe Biden, saying they have had enough of President Donald Trump.
We want everybody to know that we need to get him out of office.
Polls show Trump is losing support from voters 65 and older, a group he won by 9 percentage points in 2016.
He is losing seniors in many states, often by very substantial margins. That's a result of downplaying the coronavirus pandemic while seniors are the most vulnerable population.
Eager to win back older voters who make up 23% of the 2020 American electorate, on Friday, Trump campaigned in Florida in an event built protecting American seniors.
I will defend you and I will fight for you with every ounce of energy and conviction that I have.
Trump repeated a promise he made days after his release from hospital due to COVID, saying seniors will get the same experimental drugs that he received.
We're going to make it available to everyone who needs it for free.
While the pandemic is a factor in polling, senior support for Trump has slipped since mid-2019. One possible reason, retirees now see him as a more extreme candidate than they did 4 years ago.
More moderate candidates tend to win higher shares of the vote. So this is true of all voters in the first place. Among seniors, this is also a more moderate portion of the electorate.
Biden also traveled to a senior center in Florida this week to court older Americans.
Because Donald Trump, it's simple. Not a joke. You're expendable. You're forgettable. You're virtually nobody. That's how he sees seniors. That's how he sees you.
Trump recently tweeted a Photoshop meme of his opponent in a wheelchair surrounded by seniors. The 74-year-old president often mocks Biden, who is 77, calling him Sleepy Joe.
Trump has doubled down on the idea that Joe Biden isn't functioning well anymore, simply that he is too old, implying with no evidence that he has dementia. And of course, this doesn't play very well with a senior audience.
Who's better for seniors?
Still, the Trump campaign is not giving up on seniors, launching ads targeting older voters in key battleground states this week. Patsy Whitaker-Sawara, VOA News.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. The spread of misinformation is all around us, and it makes the search for trustworthy news that much harder. But, as Tina Trin reports, tech companies are identifying media bias and helping researchers discern the real news from the fake.
Between Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other ways Americans get their news online, many may be experiencing information overload in the run-up to Election Day. And some information isn't necessarily accurate or even true.
8 in 10 Americans are now concerned that misinformation will play a role in the outcome of the election.
But would most Americans be able to spot misinformation if they saw it?
We are expecting the news consumer to actually do the work and recognize, is this news true? Is this biased? Is it not?
That's why Harleen Kaur and her co-founders started Ground News, which claims to be the world's first news comparison platform.
So say it's a political story about elections, we'll show you how all the way from far left to far right are covering it so you can compare.
Ground News' browser extension provides this immediately for stories.
With a single click, you can then figure out what else is available. What are the other spins on the same story?
We are all biased. We're biased by everything we know, by our life experience, and everything we don't know.
John Gable is the co-founder of AllSides.com, a site that provides media bias ratings and identifies left, center, and right takes on the headlines.
We automatically bring out different points of view. So our first three results of any search you do on a news story will give you three different perspectives on that same topic.
User experience researchers like Samir Patil have found that any additional guidance can help reduce the spread of misinformation.
And this doesn't have to be very lengthy or extensive, just a short blurb that says this might be questionable or you might want to look further into it. Just that brief intervention acts as a check and reduces people's tendency or intention to share it.
Ultimately, a healthy dose of skepticism is needed.
Just at least think about, is this likely to be true? Are there factors that may make it not true? Just that brief pause and reflecting, it might be useful here.
This election season and beyond, it's one way to separate the real news from the fake news. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
There is no current evidence that dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria, such as E. coli and Salmonella, that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit www.who.int or www.cdc.gov.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, as more schools in the United States welcome children back for in-person lessons, epidemiologists are warning parents to watch for COVID symptoms. Meanwhile, researchers hope to learn more about coronavirus transmission among younger children. Anoush Advetsian tells us more in this report, narrated by Anna Rice.
It's been over a month since the daughter of Alfia Husnudinova started going to school in person. While most Maryland public schools continue to teach children online, some private schools are opting for in-person learning. That prompted Husnudinova to send her daughter to a private school, where teachers get regularly tested for COVID-19. Face masks for both children and teachers are mandatory, and school desks are spaced out.
So far, everything is fine. No one has been reported sick. I hope this will serve as an example for state schools and they open for in-person learning soon.
But not everyone sees the situation this way. Epidemiologists have long warned that once children return to the classroom, the risk of contracting COVID-19 will spike. According to an independent group, the COVID Monitor, over 39,000 cases of COVID have been registered in K-12 schools in the U.S. since the start of the school year. Like 11 other states, Maryland doesn't publish detailed information about the spread of COVID-19 among school children. And no federal system tracks the virus spread in schools. So children coming back to schools for in-person classes largely remains an experiment.
Trying to keep the same cohort of children together will really be very important. That way, if somebody in the classroom is tested positive for COVID, We know that we can basically quarantine that cohort of children without having to worry too much about the other classes.
Specialists still can't say for certain whether children easily transmit COVID-19 or not. So pediatricians urge parents to keep their children at home and take a COVID test if the kid is exhibiting any symptoms.
We think that older children, probably over the age of 10, probably can transmit the virus as easily as adults can. And clearly it's going to be important to isolate older children, high schoolers, junior high schoolers, from each other if they're showing signs or symptoms of COVID. It's the very young ones, you know, under 5 or 6 years old, there's much more controversy as to how communicative the virus is between one to the other.
Epidemiologists believe that school children should be tested for COVID-19 weekly, but that is not possible in a lot of schools. In Florida, most public schools opened in August, and so far over 10,000 children have been diagnosed with the coronavirus. Only private schools in two state counties still offer in-person classes. Ariana, daughter of Alexandra Schumacher-Hazen, goes to one such school.
If the kid has a small fever, they won't let him or her in. If the kid has a runny nose or a small cough, it's the same. They have imposed stricter rules here.
Other states are carefully watching Florida as they consider fully reopening all of the state schools. For Anusha Vitisyan in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Former model and cancer survivor Mara Soto began cooking as a hobby during the pandemic. But her new pastime is yielding quite a spread, as Genia Dulo reports.
Josephine Maurer Soto, who came to the U.S. from Germany over 20 years ago, was working as a producer in the fashion industry when the coronavirus pandemic hit in mid-March. As a cancer survivor, she decided it was safest to just stay home and not venture out. Maurer Soto decided to distract herself by baking.
So this is the sourdough starter. It is equal water and equal flour that you put together and you mix it up and then you leave it over a few days. But over a few days, you would always take a little bit out and mix a little bit more equal water, equal flour. You do it for a couple of days till it builds this kind of fermentation.
Maurer Soto, who lives in Los Angeles, makes her bread with just three ingredients, flour, water, and salt. And though it might sound easy, she says there are a lot of secrets to making a tasty loaf of bread.
It really depends on where you are, you know, so your surroundings, the weather and all this stuff is important. So I think it is about, like, being more intuitive with bread making.
At some point, Maurer Soto says her friends started asking her to bake bread for them, and that inspired her to create a micro-business, Black Forest Bakery LA. She purchased a larger stone oven and today makes about 80 loaves of bread a week, selling them for about $10 each. The business is going well, and Josephine says she has already covered all the expenses.
It's so good, and I told Josephina the story, but my mom, who's European, was staying at our house, and I had given her the bread, and immediately she said, this is European bread. This isn't the same as bread here.
I think it's the perfect in-between, a little soft, but also still crunchy, and the inside is dense and chewy. It tastes like handmade fresh bread.
Maurer Soto didn't expect to find her calling and start a business in these trying times. But she's glad she did, because fresh bread brings joy and happiness not only to her, but to the many people who love the taste. Genia Dulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Analysts say North Korea's newly unveiled intercontinental ballistic missile appears designed to overwhelm U.S. missile defenses. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, that means it is getting harder and more expensive to defend against North Korea's growing missile force, according to experts.
North Korea's biggest ICBM yet, unveiled at this nighttime military parade. The missile can almost certainly reach the United States, but its range isn't the biggest concern. North Korea has already shown it could launch missiles capable of hitting the U.S. mainland. Now, analysts say, it wants to show it can fit multiple nuclear warheads on a single ICBM. For U.S. missile defense systems shown here, multiple warheads would be much more difficult to intercept, says analyst Melissa Hannum.
If you have multiple warheads coming out of that single missile, you now have to have multiple interceptors for each incoming warhead.
If the U.S. felt it needed to continually add interceptors, that would be expensive, much more expensive than what it would cost North Korea to build more missiles.
The challenge with missile defense is that it's always cheaper and easier to make a new missile than it is to make the vast missile defense system, which involves sensors to detect, involves multiple interceptors for each single missile.
The North Korean ICBM does have drawbacks, however. With 22 wheels, its launcher vehicle is so large, it may not be very mobile, and it would take a long time to set up and fuel. It is also untested, but that could soon change, says analyst Bruce Klingner.
What I would expect is to see that ICBM tested next year. What North Korea tends to do is something very provocative in the first year of a new U.S. or South Korean administration. So regardless of who the U.S. president is next year, I'd expect to see this new ICBM tested.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un may be reluctant to conduct a major test before the November 3rd U.S. election. But earlier this year, Kim said he no longer feels bound by his self-imposed moratorium on nuclear and long-range missile tests. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
You'll find so much more on this story and all the others you hear on today's program by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. You'll also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram and YouTube. And, of course, you can find us on our website. That's voanews.com. Female journalists in Pakistan are demanding an end to online harassment, including threats of sexual assault that they face for their work. After several journalists posted a petition on social media calling for action, the government proposed a new law to curb the harassment. But some journalists have warned that such legislation could be used to limit speech. Gady Ara Anis reports for VOA from Islamabad.
Muniza Jahangir, a renowned broadcast journalist in Pakistan, is one of the 15 original signatories of the petition against online harassment. The hostility often comes from social media users who support or are affiliated with one of Pakistan's political parties. Jahangir told VOA that the harassment of female journalists goes beyond simple differences of opinion.
We have all been subjected to professional criticism, but these are personal attacks on female journalists. These attacks are sexist in nature. They involve the threats of sexual assaults and rapes. This was the point when we thought, no, they have crossed the red line and we have to take action.
Since August, the number of complainants has increased from 15 journalists to 150. Pakistan's Parliamentary Secretary of Human Rights, Lal Chand Malhi, says a new law is needed to stop the harassment.
The ministry has drafted Protection of Journalists Bill 2020. Cabinet has approved it, and now it is with the Ministry of Information and Broadcast for their input. We intend to table it in Parliament soon. Political parties need to be brought into a framework, so they are bound to abide by certain rules.
Most women journalists do not favor a new law and rejected the idea in a recent statement.
This government and even the previous governments always tried to regulate social media. One reason could be the kind of freedom the medium gives to you. Many issues that could not be raised on regular media are easily discussed on social forums. But what happened with the 2016 Prevention of Electronic Crimes Bill was justified as a means to protect women online. We all know how it is misused.
Sadaf Khan, who heads the group Media Matters for Democracy,
played a major role in drafting the complaint. She says online harassment has less to do with the laws and more to do with political culture.
Our first demand is that political parties should consolidate a code of ethics for their social media cells, their supporter. The parties should openly condemn and stop this online abusive culture of threats and harassment. They should convey to their support base that this behavior is not acceptable and penalize the offender. Second, the Federal Investigation Agency should play an active role in lodging complaints against people, especially those who are powerful or in government. We demand a fair treatment of our cases.
The Human Rights Parliamentary Secretary believes that the new law will be a huge help in persuading political parties to play a positive role in bringing about a cultural change. A survey by Media Matters for Democracy found that 77% of female journalists in Pakistan resort to self-censorship to avoid online harassment. Journalists believe that no law will sensitize the general public. They say only the political parties can do that by sending a strong message to party workers to stop unethical activities or face penalties. Geeti Aranis for VOA News, Islamabad.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden held competing town halls at the end of last week to reach out to voters in separate forums at the same time. Mike O'Sullivan has more on the televised events just weeks before the election, November 3rd.
It should have been a head-to-head debate, but after Trump announced October 2nd he had contracted COVID-19, organizers made the event virtual and Trump refused to participate. Instead, there were rival town halls in the battleground states of Pennsylvania and Florida, Trump trailing in the polls and trying to make up for lost time. The event was broadcast by NBC News.
I was in North Carolina today and did a big rally with tremendous turnout, and I just feel really good. Florida, Pennsylvania, we're all over the place.
Trump defended his response to COVID-19, blocking flights from China in late January. That response gets a failing grade, said Biden, who appeared in a town hall moderated by George Stephanopoulos of ABC News.
It is a presidential responsibility to lead, and he didn't do that. He didn't talk about what needed to be done because he kept worrying, in my view, about the stock market.
Biden said Trump should have pressed state governors and mayors to enforce restrictions he says could have saved more lives. Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, is in Senate confirmation hearings this week, and if confirmed, could help decide a contested election.
It would be totally up to her. I would think that she would be able to rule either for me or against me. I don't see any conflict whatsoever.
Biden won't rule out expanding the high court to change the balance.
Well, I'm not a fan. I didn't say it depends on how this turns out.
The candidates agree on one thing.
We have an election coming up. I think it's the most important election in the history of our country.
Biden promised to work with Republicans if elected.
Because there's so many things we really do agree on.
But much separates the parties. Early voting has started in many states, and Trump warns of widespread fraud. Most election experts say that has not happened. Trump was asked if he will accept the results of the election.
And the answer is yes, I will. But I want it to be an honest election, and so does everybody else.
The candidates are scheduled to meet 1 week from now in a final face-to-face debate. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. Presidential campaign ads on television and social media are targeting voters with different messages designed for different media platforms. VOA's Steve Reddish explains the messaging campaign.
They said it couldn't be done, but President Trump did it.
Whether it is President Donald Trump.
I will not abandon you. We're all in this together.
or former Vice President Joe Biden, campaign advertising is all over television and social media feeds.
The television advertising campaigns are generally persuasion campaigns. They're just trying to change hearts and minds.
Jennifer Stromer-Galley is a professor in the School of Information Studies at Syracuse University. She heads a project that examines presidential campaign advertising on Facebook and Instagram.
Campaigns use social media ads to raise money, to find voters, and also to get better a better picture of who their supporters likely are and what their supporters get excited to hear.
Stromer-Galley says the campaigns produce many different social media advertisements to see what sticks with voters.
And so they'll run hundreds of variants of an ad to see what message really speaks to voters. And the one that gets engagement, that is clicks back to the campaign website, those that are ones that they're more likely than to run more broadly.
Once you click onto a campaign ad, the mining for personal information begins.
And the more of that information they can get from you, the better they can match that then to potentially you and their databases they already have. And if they don't yet have you, now they have you in their databases and can then start building profiles that predict whether or not you're likely to vote for them on election day and then what kinds of messages they should be sending to you on Facebook to try to get you to turn out to vote or to get more involved.
Instead of a call for action, television ad campaigns generally highlight a candidate's character, leadership, and policies.
So, for example, I've noticed the Trump's advertising on television and the idea that fracking is a major policy matter that is a differentiator between the Republicans and the Democrats. And they think that issue is resonating. So that's something they're going to advertise and hope that persuades some people to go, oh, yeah, that's an issue that I care a lot about.
Stromer-Galley says President Trump's ad campaign differs from Biden's.
In his advertisements, he's more likely to talk about issues than Joe Biden is. Biden has kind of been running as the anti-Trump. And so you don't really see him talking at length or really in much to much extent about policy and issue topics in his campaign advertising.
Ads on social media cost a fraction of advertising on TV. According to the Wesleyan Media Project, Trump is outspending Biden on social media by about 22%, while Biden is outspending Trump on television by 28%. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. presidential election is just 2 weeks from tomorrow. Its results affect Asia and the entire world. Already, millions of U.S. voters have cast early ballots in response to the coronavirus pandemic and amid a very turbulent campaign season between two very different candidates. VOA Asia is keeping you up to date each day with all of the latest developments ahead of Election Day, and of course we'll share all of the results of the election from the November 3rd polls. There's also much to see and read on our social media platforms as well as our website, voanews.com.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, Judge Amy Coney Barrett, U.S. President Donald Trump's nominee to fill the vacancy left on the Supreme Court by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg last month, cleared the first hurdle to her confirmation. In four marathon hearing days, Barrett deflected questions on how she would rule on issues from abortion to the election to gun rights. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the next steps in the process.
A preview of the fight to come.
I'm not going to sit on the sidelines and watch one of our nominees be destroyed after showing respect for two Democratic nominees. That is not right.
Democrats objecting as President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett moves forward just a few weeks before the election.
This nomination at this moment in time is not usual, not normal, and it's beneath the dignity of this committee. We should have played by the rules.
During two marathon days of questioning, Barrett offered few insights on how she would rule on cases impacting millions of Americans.
I can't take policy positions or express my personal views before the committee because my personal views don't have anything to do with how I would decide cases.
Drawing praise from Republicans for her judicial philosophy.
You got a lifetime appointment, and if you do lawmaking, we can't vote you out of office.
And frustration from Democrats who say if Barrett is seated, she could be the deciding vote on an upcoming case that could dismantle the Affordable Care Act.
Health care coverage for millions of Americans is at stake with this nomination.
But first, the Supreme Court could be asked to rule on disputes related to millions of absentee ballots.
If she decides in the president's favor in any election-related dispute, it's going to cause grievous harm to both the court and indeed our democracy.
Polling shows a slight majority of voters think the nomination should wait until after the election on November 3rd.
He wants to pack the court!
But as the American public has learned more about Barrett, a mother of seven and devout Catholic, support for her nomination has grown. With early voting already underway, the confirmation hearing could have an impact on voters' decisions. The Senate Judiciary Committee returns next Monday to prepare Barrett's nomination for a full floor vote the week of October 26. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The coronavirus pandemic has increased poverty and hunger for many in 2020, according to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. And in places like Africa and Asia, conflict and climate change have made an already dire situation even worse. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
The UN's Food and Agricultural Organization says its efforts to fight hunger have been set back 10 years due to the coronavirus pandemic. FAO's chief economist, Maximo Torreira Collins, says the problem is not a lack of food, but access to it.
People won't have access to food because they are losing their jobs, because they don't have the income. Developing countries will be facing significant challenges because of recession in the world. And therefore, that is what explains why undernourishment could increase to 132 million and poverty.
He predicts poverty will get worse.
We are expecting an increase in poverty, which goes up to 150 million more people moving into extreme poverty. We are expecting up to 132 million people moving to undernourishment.
The most vulnerable, he says, are those exposed to unrest or climate change.
In sub-Saharan Africa, in the Sahel area, most of them were already facing conflict. Most of them were already facing huge shocks of climate, or they were facing locust, the problem that we have in Eastern Africa.
East Africa saw a devastating outbreak of locust swarms this year. In Kenya, it was the worst plague of the voracious insects in 70 years, taking a toll on the livelihood of millions. Although the pandemic has hit other parts of the world harder, such as in the United States and Europe, a survey by the International Committee of the Red Cross found that respondents in Africa have been affected since the start of the pandemic. ICRC's Alimatu Amadou spoke to VOA from Dakar.
And this survey was done among 2,400 people in 10 African countries. And what those people we have interviewed say is really a worry.
She says only 7% of the people said they had enough savings to cope with the current situation. Beyond Africa, the FAO is particularly worried about Latin America, which has also been hit hard by COVID-19. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.